I got it. I'm ready. I tell you, there's times... before we begin tonight, we must once again give a disclaimer that the following program in no way, shape, or form represents the attitude of the management, nor of the people involved connected with the production of said show. God only knows where it comes from, but nevertheless, just thought you ought to know. There are certain elements of the show that could be very distasteful to people of sense and perspicacity. I thought you ought to warn, let you know about that. Because right down the dial, they're doing a salute to Julie Andrews. I think you'll enjoy that. And a retrospective appreciation of the work of Chubby Checkers. All these big important things are going on. Bring it up. Oh, yes, there's a lady that's being interviewed who paints cats on velvet. That's big and important for radio, yeah. Thank you, Matt. Oh, no, that's all right. Just keep it up there. Let them off the hook that easy. Oh, no way, man. One thing Shepard's got, he hangs in there, man. He's got hooks on his toes. He climbs right up the side of a sheer brick wall. The human fly of the entertainment field. And if you think you can get a fly swatter big enough to deal with me, friend, you're willing and ready to try. I have busted many a fly swatter. Hey, you say you like this suit here that I have. I don't wear suits very often. Hey, no. I'm the direct opposite of Johnny Carson. You can't imagine Johnny Carson in his jockey shorts. No way. And you like this. Well, this comes in a kit, Matt. And, everything. People like to work with their hands. And I sent away to the Heath Kit people. And they... Wonderful thing. It's called Build-A-Suit. BILDASUT. Build-A-Suit. And it just gives you something to do, By the way, speaking of kits, I would like to salute anybody out there who has attempted to build a very elaborate kit and 5 minutes into the building of the kit realized that you were not a craftsman. And now you're left with a $742 life-size working model of a Wankel engine. And it's hidden back there amid all the overshoes. Let me tell you, I read a fantastic statistic along that. People have incredible ideas of what kind of talent they've got. Very few people will concede that they are about as talented as your average potato. They just won't concede this. And so they're constantly attempting things which are way above and beyond them. I just wonder how many guitars have been bought in America since 1969. Now, the next question is, out of all those guitars bought, how many would you estimate, Matt? Lee, would you estimate, please? You don't know. Matt, just give a rough estimate. 100,000? All right, let's 200,000. More. 300,000. We're getting there, huh? 400,000. Okay. 400,000 guitars. Now, that's a hell of a lot of G-strings. 400,000 guitars. Now, that's just an estimate of our technical expert here in charge of the program, Matt Bayless. Now, Matt says he estimates 400,000 guitars have been sold since 1969. This is 74. Okay. Now, the next question arises, and this is a Shepard, we call this Shepard's Failure Hypothesis. That's in capital letters, and will be on the final exam for this semester. So please write down Shepard's Failure Hypothesis. All right? Shepard's Failure Hypothesis holds that for every spectacular project undertaken by the average walking around citizen of the realm, less than 0.1% of said projects are ever completed, even badly. Now, that 0.1% figure has been derived at by a lot of empirical work, so don't fool around with it. You write it down in your notebook just the way I gave it to you, and don't question me, right? Now, what I'm saying here, out of the 400,000 guitars that were sold, I would suggest at this point less than 35 guitars of that 400,000 are actually being played with any degree of skill by the purchasers of the 400,000 guitars. You'd say more than that? Why would you say that? How many friends of yours have you known that have become expert guitar players? That's right, zero. Then where the hell are you getting your figures? You're just assuming you got a bunch of cloddy friends, which may very well be true. I concede that. But that's the case with all of us. I have not known a person yet who did not have a collection of clods for friends. Okay, I'm sorry, I just got to bring it out in the open. There are times when truth is absolutely the only bastion of hope and fidelity that you can cling to. Now, I'm not putting these people down who did not learn to play the guitar. I am merely pointing out that these are part of the vast ocean of Sargasso Sea victims, of people who have been brought down by their own curious lack of ability to discern their own lack of talent. In other words, overreachers. Well, I give you, you know what the latest fad is? Have you seen these ads all over the place for build your own airplane? You've seen that. You know, the BD-5 and all that stuff. You've said, yeah, there it is, popular mechanics. Well, I'm going to tell you something about that, friends. You want to hear a little terrible... not only does building an airplane have to do with building an airplane, it has to do with learning to fly in a little mother. And that itself is a 10-year proposition for a lot of people. So you're really biting off of not only more than you can chew, you're biting off a bite bigger than most people can ever see. Well, okay. Do you know that one of the companies that turns out kits for airplanes, and this is a recognized aircraft, that's a kit, you can buy it. You know, they come up with these glowing ads, $2,000, and you can have your own airplane. And it shows a picture of a guy flying into the sunset, and every guy sitting out there reading this says, oh, God, yeah, I could get away from her. It's only a one-seater, yeah. Oh, man. Fly forever into the sunset, yes. Soaring, gliding, mystic. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, yes. And by the way, that is part of our sad national mania these days. Would you get ready number one there for me, Matt? This is also appearing on this coming semester's exam. Write it down. Shepherd's definition of the Jonathan Livingston Seagull fatal syndrome. Did you write it down? Get that thing reset in there, Matt, because we're going to just have to lay it on you. You have noticed that Jonathan Livingston Seagull spent 900 lugubrious pages learning how to fly. There is only one false note in the entire, and by the way, it's a fatal false note, and that is, anybody who's ever seen a seagull of any type knows that seagulls are born knowing how to fly. And you ain't. So you ain't Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Now, if Richard Bach, what a piece of glutinagious glop that Jonathan Livingston Seagull is. Now, if he had written an entire book on how Jonathan Livingston Seagull, a seagull, was spending his entire life learning how to do a television talk show, that would be something for a seagull to undertake. Do you agree? That would be the unattainable dream. I can just see Jonathan, this magic, mystical seagull, squatting next to a piling down on one of the lesser beaches south of Coney Island with the beer cans floating in from the sea. And he's squatting down there dreaming of the day when he, too, will sit in front of a beaded screen and say, and our guest tonight is Zsa Zsa Gabor. You won't see that. Now, on the other hand, if Richard Bach had written a mystical piece of work on how, let's say, Merv Griffin was suddenly struck with this unattainable dream, if he could only learn to fly by flapping his arms and do slow barrel rolls in the sun, practicing stalls higher and higher and higher above the flock that usually hangs around Lindy's. There he goes, down in flames. Ooh, Ishka Bibble. I couldn't have done it better if you tried, Matt. That was magnificent. That was Merv Griffin going into the sea after he discovered that his that his flaps are ineffective, right? He discovered that the aileron control was somewhat faulty, that wiggling his left hand and his right hand at the same time did not give him enough aileron control, and he went into an uncontrollable spin, crashing into the sea just off East Montauk. Gone forever. And unmissed. I love Merv Griffin. Merv Griffin is for me. Oh, Merv. Oh, Mike Douglas. We pledge our fealty to thee. Give me a little music. I'll sing that, too. Go. Come on. We got a big Mac. Come on. Let's have it. We need power. 5'2", eyes of blue. Oh, what a little ducky you was. Oh, little old Merv Griffin. Ba-da-da-da-boom. Ba-da-da-da-doo-doo. Anybody seen my gal?
Now if you run into 5'2", all covered with fur.
Yeah.
She's got diamond rings and all those things. You bet your life that it isn't.
Here we go. Nice.
Gucci love
me. Gucci little kitchen cool.
Has anybody seen my gal?
Anybody seen my gal? She walks like a duck and waddles like a pig. Has anybody seen my gal? Oh, you can tell her coming down the street by them yellow teeth. Walking along, well, Bob-a-doo-doo-doo-doo. This is Satcher, 5'2", eyes of blue. Oh, has anybody seen that gal? My blue, ba-da-doo, my gal. Oh, blue, ba-da-doo.
Hold.
That's enough. We got to leave them wanting more, man. Got to leave them panting to hear the second chorus. You want to hear the other side? He's got plans of his own in there. I don't blame him. We should all have an escape hatch. Hey, listen, speaking of escape hatches, fellow victims, could you do something for me in there, Matthew, please, when you get that thing set up in there? Could you give me an echo chamber? I sure you can. Hello,
1, 2, 3.
I'm going to make an invisible Chinese gong. I want you to close your eyes now, and you can smell the scent of jasmine. And you have that funny feeling that you get once in a while when the hairs on your neck slowly rise. You are returning to your forebears, the wolf. You are walking into the lair of the great Dr. Fu Manchu. Very good. How many of you know that Dr. Fu Manchu took his undergraduate work at Columbia? He did. You know, he's Dr. Fu Manchu. Do you ever hear of him, Matt? Well, very few people know where he matriculated. They use the word doctor. They don't realize that he is a doctor. And I will award a brass fig legee with bronze oak leaf palm to any of you out there, literary students, who can tell me what his doctorate is in. And I'd also like to tell you this, that when he was a student at Columbia, working in the undergraduate world there, Dr. Fu Manchu used to eat regularly at the House of Chan, which is at 52nd Street and 7th Avenue. Oh, yes, and for good reason he ate at the House of Chan. It's one of the most majestic Chinese restaurants in all of New York City. Tremendous food. They have an excellent bar, an elegant bar. And more than that, it's a place that has been sort of a landmark in New York City, even since the days when Dr. Fu Manchu was, in fact, a freshman at Columbia and making friends and winning all kinds of awards right from the start. I wonder how many of you know that he's a letterman, and he was a member of a varsity sport team up at Columbia. What was the team he was on? Well, he trained eating the majestic, fantastic food at the House of Chan. They're open 7 days a week, friends, and if it was good enough for Dr. Fu Manchu, and look how far he went, he almost took over the world. You know who one of his best friends was? Dr. No. He and Dr. No had a practice on East 67th Street for a while together, hung out a shingle. And, well, you know, they fell out, but they both had the same dream, the same impossible ambitions. And it came from eating the fantastic food at the House of Chan. So if your life has been humdrum, if your sex life has been ho-hum, I would suggest you drop into the House of Chan. Their food is pure erotic experience. That's at 52nd Street, 7th Avenue. They're open 7 days a week. They're a fantastic place to go before you go to the theater. And, you know, pay $27 for a seat way up someplace outside of the Kinney parking lot to watch some chick sing off in the distance you can't even hear, and it's a bad show anyway. So why don't you go and enjoy a good meal before the show. The House of Chan, 52nd Street and 7th Avenue, just down the street from WOR, New York. Would you give me those American Motor bugles, please?
Your AMC dealers got the all-new midsize car that economizes on everything but comfort. That car, the roomy 74 Matador. And another important advantage, our 74 Matador comes with an economical six-cylinder engine as standard equipment. And consider this, Matador is the only new midsize car backed by all the benefits of the exclusive AMC Buyer Protection Plan. Which means that under normal usage and accepting tires, if anything AMC did goes wrong with your new 74 Matador in the first 12 months or 12,000 miles, we'll fix or replace it free. Come in today. Meet the unbeatable combination. 74 Matador backed by the AMC Buyer Protection Plan.
Yeah, see your AMC dealer where you get a good deal. And a good deal more. Yeah. Oh, that was beautiful. Beautiful. And if you'd like to be beautiful, the thin, svelte, lovely you that lurks inside that big, fat, slobby exterior, we would like to recommend Hollywood bread. You know that the average slice of bread contains less calories than a medium-sized grapefruit? So does oranges, apples, and many other fruits. Shouldn't use that expression. Not in New York. The bakers of Hollywood bread have made it easier for bread lovers who wish to lose weight. Would you hate to describe yourself as a bread lover? I mean, you know, there's lovers of art, there's lovers of beauty, lovers of truth, and you're a bread lover. They are offering Eleanor Hansberry's Calorie and Carbohydrate Guide free wherever Hollywood bread is sold. I can just see that bumper sticker. I'm a bread lover. You know, a little heart with a loaf of bread in the middle of it with an arrow going through it. I'm a bread lover. Did you see the bumper sticker? I saw a great one the other day. It says, eat more possum. Well, that's right. I don't make the news. I only report it, friends. I saw one that says, impeach Walter Cronkite. Well, you know, that wasn't so good, was it? Wasn't so good. Well, you do your best. You know, while we're on the subject of that car, you heard that car commercial there. You know, I heard a sad case the other day. Well, it had a happy ending, which kind of added a little soupçon of delicacy to the situation. But a friend of mine was having these shooting pains all the time. He had pains in his arms and, just bad pains. He'd sit around and he did all kinds of stuff. Wait, we have a note here. It says, here's a bumper sticker. It says, keep your city clean. Eat a pigeon today. It's not bad. All right, George. I saw one also that says, impeach Alistair Cook. So, you know, you do the best you can. Oh, yeah, I saw another one that says, in spite of what all of you say, Don Rickles is funny. So there. That's the answer to the Phyllis Diller syndrome. You know, I met a person here the other day. I was amazed. I met a person who actually thought Phyllis Diller's funny. And it was very, very interesting to meet this person. Also collected medieval tapestry. The same person. Very nice. And he wore tennis shoes, by the way, with a corduroy suit, so I suppose that answers a lot. Oh, yes, I was going to tell you about this friend with the shooting pains. Well, now, wait a minute. You never thought about this. I never did, really. You know, a lot of things I don't think about. But this particular thing ever hit me. This guy had pains. And he was always having trouble with his knee. And he was getting very testy, very, very angry all the time. And he's married to this lady, a fantastic girl. You know, the kind that makes... Vanessa Redgrave look like a brownie. You know, really fantastic looking chick. And and she's absolutely full of empathy and clings to him and all that stuff. But in spite of that, he was saying, oh, get off. Why? Oh, quit pushing me around, will you? Hey, quit hanging on me, for crying out loud. And, you know, just bad, bad, bad. Well, this continued for about a year, getting worse and worse. And one day... apparently unconnected, the situation, he decided he was going to trade his car in. And he took the car down to the place where they trade cars in, you know, Friendly Fred, the hungry Armenian. And he took his car in there. Of course, he just bought the car there about a year and a half ago, just before, you know, he paid $12,000, about like that. You know, well, what, you know, it was an economy model. So he bought this car from this guy. And had him out maybe 8,000 miles on, just barely broken in, takes it in, and drives it up to the office there. He wanted to get a new model, so he walks in. There's Friendly Fred sitting there, the guy who had sold him this car, told him it was a fantastic machine. And he'd be totally happy with it. It would make him 10 years younger, and more than that, that would add to his image. It would state something to the world about him, what a man of taste and achievement he was. So he gets out of his car and he walks into the office. There's Friendly Fred sitting there picking his chromium teeth with a nail. And he says, Fred, back again. Fred says, yes, so what? He's expecting trouble, right? So my friend says, I'm here to trade in the Whoopi-Mobile 8 that I got here 18 months ago, and I'd like to try the 1974 model. And Fred says, yes, so? He says, well, I'd like to make a deal. You know, I drove my car in. You told me it was a fantastic car for high resale value. You told me that it was a car that would be loved and cherished by the ages. It was, in fact, a modern classic. And I would like to trade in my modern classic with high resale value for the 1974 model. A long, pregnant pause. Fred turns, spits in the water cooler, and says, you kidding? He says, no, I'm not kidding. I want to trade it in. He says, okay, drive your old heap back around to the back there, and I'll have that. What color do you want, the 74? At which point my friend says, but what are you going to give me on the new, on the trade, on the new car, you know? What are you going to give me for the old one? My God. Oh, well, let's see. Book value is $212. But I can't give you that because book value is for a car of what we call optimum mileage. That means less than 400 miles. You've driven your car 8,000 miles. My God, that car is old. Let's see, take a look at the rubber. I'll give you $75, and that's only because you're an old customer. Well, my friend sat down heavily on the camp chair that is the luxurious furniture in Friendly Fred's showroom. He sat down heavily and said, $75! And at that point, Fred says, look, what do you expect? $75. Well, all right, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you include the stereo radio that you put in at $1,252, the one with the 8-track stereo in there, if you'll include the radio, I'll give you $90 right on a barrel head, not a cent more. Well, my friend staggers back, and he says, well, he says, where's the high resale value that you talked about, Fred? And Fred says, come on. He says, yeah, you talk. He says, what is a high resale value? Any guy that expects more than $90 for his car in a trade-in is crazy. That car's not worth $15 on a trade-in. And at that, my friend says, I'll show you. And he rushes out and he runs down to Big Auto Big Otto ran the rival outfit down. Big Otto was the hungry German. And he goes into Big Otto's and he says, Big Otto, I've just been offered $150 from Friendly Fred down there on my Whoopmobile 8. And I'd like to see what kind of... I'm not going to mess around with that guy. If you top his offer, and by the way, he had a big sign, we top anybody's offer, we'll meet anybody's offer anytime, any place, 24 hours a day. See our Wednesday TV special now, on the lot. And he drives in, he says, okay, he says, I'm ready here, you're going to top Fred's offer. He says, Fred offered you $150 on that car, and it's a 73, are you out of your mind? You better go back there and get that $150, man, and I'm going to send every car I got down to Fred's. Well, my man walked out on the street, staggering back. He realized that this 8,000 miles that he had put on this car cost him roughly, well, he paid $12,000 for the car for starters. That's about $1,300 for every 1,000 miles he drove, plus the fact that he got 0.9 gallons to the gas on the downhill run with the switch off, in addition to the fact that they charged him $374 to fix the tear in the front seat cover there, where the mechanic, who was doing the 400-mile check on his car, had ripped it with a screwdriver he had in his back pocket, and he wouldn't admit they'd done it. Well, he walked out a sadder but wiser man. And you know what he did? I'll tell you what he did. It was a very interesting story. He took his $8,000 car home and parked it in the garage. Sat there for a while. He realized he couldn't get gas for it anymore. He realized the car was an anomaly in today's life. And he and his friends got together and pushed it out of the garage. He'd used the last ounce of gas that he had. It only took him maybe 15, 20 gallons to get back from Fred's used car lot, which was 7 blocks away. And he got out of the car, they pushed it out, and he made it into the most beautiful fern planter you have ever seen. Magnificent fern planter, and he had it brought into the living room. He took the doors off, and now he and his wife sit in it and talk about the old days when they used to go driving. And he turns on his 8-track stereo and grows ferns in the trunk. And so it did have a happy ending. By the way, his muscle ache went away. His knee got better. His sex life improved 400%, and his psychiatrist told him that he was having what he calls, in the new modern psychological parlance, a recessive, I bought a lemon, trauma. Now, many guys are driving lemons around, which they will not admit that they are driving lemons around. You remember those great TV commercials they used to have where it was a guy driving a lemon? You remember he actually had a lemon? Yeah, it was a big fat lemon. Yeah, it was a great looking lemon. Yeah, it had wheels on the bottom. And do you know the one car company that commercial became so popular? One car company was thinking of bringing out a lemon model. We could actually have your own lemon and come out and right admit it. You know, it's called the Truth model, and you can drive along, throw the seeds out once in a while. But you know, six of one, half a dozen the other. You pick them up and you lay them down. And I was just thinking here today. You know, you see these bumper stickers, and everywhere you hear people complaining and, you know, griping. I just to make you feel better, friends, have you envied those friends of yours who were winners? Have you really? Or don't you have any friends like that, Matt? I'll tell you, if you do have friends that are winners, they wouldn't be your friends long. One thing you got to admit about a winner, he knows when to shuck the dead wood out of his life. And I might add, many of you are floating pretty good these days. How many of you feel like you got bark on your head? You don't know what deadwood is? Okay, all right. We won't say anything about that. We'll just leave that float. But I will say this, though, that if you think you've got it bad and you envy winners, please prepare number one in there for me, man. I'm going to call it for it here. A Niles, Michigan man. Now, I've been in Niles, Michigan. It's a nice little town. You know Niles, Michigan? It's you know, whenever you think of a typical American Midwestern city, you know, with apple-cheeked ladies running in and out of the frozen food department buying the Jolly Green Giant stuff. You know that. They always show them on TV. Ladies are constantly talking about detergent. And they're squeezing the Charmin all the time. Well, that's a typical, wonderful, clean Midwestern world, which they try to transmit on television commercials. Now, have you been recently in a supermarket? There's a supermarket I go to that I want to tell you, the frozen food counter has not been defrosted probably since the late 1910s. And you could see terrible things down there frozen in the ice. I mean, products they don't make anymore. They haven't made these products for 100 years, you see frozen in the ice down there. You know, like there's a bottle of Castoria down there. And how it got in the frozen food. And there's somebody's shoe. I can see it now. And it's upside down. I can see the sole of the shoe. And I keep, you know, every time I look at it, I'm worried that the guy might be hooked onto the shoe head downward in the ice. You know, one day, I don't know. And I'm standing in this terrible supermarket. I mean, super, wow. You know, the clerks are running around with their dirty, rotten aprons. And the other day I asked the clerk, I says, hey, where's the pork and beans? He says, none of your damn business. Out of my way, buddy. And he runs past, knocks me down. And he had what they call an instant price-changing kit with him. Now, what is an instant price-changing kit? Well, you know those little purple things that they stamp on there? Well, the new instant price-changing kit is a stamp that is indecipherable. It's a blur. And so the guy at the checkout counter can call it anything he wants. And so you look at it, see, it's 49 cents. Are you kidding? You can't buy anything in a supermarket for 49 cents. You can't even buy 49 cents in a supermarket for 49 cents. And so it's 49 cents. It looks like it's kind of a blur. And you take it up to the guy, and the guy looks at it, and he says, it'll be $12.50. Boom, like that. And you bought it. And you said, $12.50? He says, yeah. Hey, how much is this, Artie? And he holds it up, and the guy says, $13. He says, well, because it's $12.50, I gave you the price. I'll give it to you for that. Have you noticed that, by the way? Have you noticed that the people can adjust to unbelievable prices if they're convinced that if they're not careful, it's going to be more? You notice that? That's a fascinating side of us. In other words, I don't want to get into that dish of tea, but nevertheless, I watched this commercial scene. That everything is so nice. They never show you the typical dirty supermarket, do they? You know, with a lot of angry ladies walking around pushing carts into your kidneys. And everybody is so flexible. You know, the other day I walked into the store and I went, wee-o! And nobody cared. Nobody gave a damn. You know, one guy said, hey, what are you doing there, bud? And I said, wee-o! He says, hey, here's another one, Mac. Come on, let's move along, buddy. And out I went into the street. You try, you do your best. But here is a man I would like to recommend to those of you who think life is bad. Listen to this one. Niles, Michigan. A Niles man has been found dead in the luxury automobile that he bought with the first $20,000 installment on his $200,000 Michigan lottery winnings. And not only that, wait till you hear about this. His death was discovered shortly after noon Saturday when his wife noticed that the garage door was open and the car was sitting in there, and he just never came out. Officers said they found him with one foot out of the car, just sitting in there with the radio full on. And his daughter said, and we quote, my father loved the new Cadillac so much that he would spend hours, weeks, in fact, he'd spend the whole weekend just sitting in there listening to the tape deck or watching the color television in the set. And not only that, you know, it's got a bar and a refrigerator in it. And he was found in that magnificent, luxurious boat of total excitement, gone from this world. Now, there's only one motto that you can get out of, one moral that you can get out of this, and I have to quote George Ade in this. May I? When prosperity comes, do not use all of it at once. When prosperity comes... How many guys get this great desire to just blow the whole damn roll just now, you know? Have you ever, you walk down the street, everybody's got a little money in the bank, you know, he's got, everybody. You know, see, because we're basically squirrels. We are closer to squirrels than we are lions. And why do I say that? I'm talking about in the psychological realm of the animal world. Because the lion does not save a zebra for a rainy day. When a lion knocks over a zebra, he eats up that whole thing, including the ears, the nose. He'll even eat the mane, he'll eat the hoofs, and then he walks around belching for a while and sits down and sleeps in the sun. He does not save zebras for a rainy day. Because the lion is smarter than we are. He knows it may never rain. And he also figures, you know, who knows? I may get stepped on by a hippo tomorrow morning. So why save the zebra for those that are going to come after me? Forget it. No lion has ever been troubled with estate taxes. And there has never been any lion known to walk into a lawyer's office and say, I want to make out my will. No way, because he uses it right up as he gets it. He lives on the edge of ecstasy. Most of us are living for a mythical tomorrow. Practically every man I know figures one day this light bulb is going to light over his head, the sun is going to shine, and there he is. He's going to be on the fantail of a yacht off Bimini. And he's going to be somehow, there's going to be ladies that look a little bit like Ursula Andress crawling all over him with bikinis. He's going to be younger and flatter and leaner and madder and hungrier. And he's going to be catching fish and writing great books and all this stuff. He's going to be doing it all in this mythical day. And so for that reason, he keeps putting little acorns in the bank down at the end of the street. You know, preparing for that great day that's going to come. Now, have you ever had this? And let's just assume that most guys do this, right? Do you assume that, Orville? Do you? How about you, man? You do. Lee, you agree. Okay. This is known as the squirrel jackdaw syndrome. Now, you know what jackdaws are? These are birds that go out and pick up marbles. And no bird has ever been a good marble player. For some reason or other, birds, jackdaws, have an insane desire to collect marbles. And they do. They have nests full of thousands of marbles. And not only marbles, but golf balls. And no jackdaw, to my knowledge, has ever mastered the middle woods. There has never been a jackdaw that I knew who could putt worth a damn. But nevertheless, they collect golf balls. They collect marbles. Obviously, they are under the illusion one day they will take up marble playing. And they can have a great collection of marbles. That's called the jackdaw syndrome. Now, we're part of this thing. Now, what happens is a man goes through his entire life. He may do this for 30 years. I mean, he's living like he was working at the grocery store when he was 15. You know, he thinks twice before he buys himself a Milky Way candy bar because you don't want to be too, you know, you don't want to blow your wad just like this, you know. And I know guys that are earning $75,000 a year who wear shoes that have cleverly concealed in the soles cut out Daily News editorials to keep their feet from touching the you know. I know guys that live like that. I know one guy who has not bought a new suit of jockey shorts underwear since 1971, and he's proud of it. He's, my God, he says, if these jockey shorts were good enough for my father, they're good enough for me. They're a family heirloom. They hand them down generation to generation. Well, now, let's carry this a little further. Have you ever had, though, every man has this, I submit to you, there's the other side. It is true that in most cases, the squirrel side of man has taken over to a large extent. You agree? However, there still remains in every man, because we're a very complex animal, there is one small, tiny sliver of lion. Now, we attempt constantly to suppress that. Because the lion side is the one that's either going to make you into a fantastic star, or it's going to kill you. You can't tell which. The squirrel side does nothing but walk around and crack nuts. That's all. No squirrel has ever died of overeating. No squirrel has ever died of drinking too much Jack Daniels. no squirrel has ever died sitting in the front seat of his $20,000 Cadillac with a color TV set running in it with an 8-track stereo. No way. What would the squirrel have? He would have a rubber band driven Volkswagen. At best. At best. Now, I would like to suggest, I shouldn't do this, but it's late enough at night, and I figured that if you're listening to the radio, you've got to have problems anyway, so we might as well just lay it out, right? That I suggest that within every one of us lies that tiny sliver of lion. And when you walk in, have you ever had that experience? You walk into the bank, see, to lay in, once again, to walk up to the teller, to give him your little weekly collection of acorns that he puts back there in the hollow tree, so that one day, when this fantastic day occurs, then you'll have your little pile of acorns, and you can go out and call up Ursula Andress and get your boat going and all that stuff. See, have you ever had just the slightest ambition, just once, to walk, when you walk in the bank, see, and you're writing out on all these things, and you got your book out, you got your checkbook, and you're writing the numbers down. Have you ever had the slight little voices, "Hey, Fred." And you say, "Yes." Then the voice goes, "Bleh!" It's a roar in the jungle of your soul. It is the lion inside of you calling and beating down the squirrel. And then the voice says, "Hey, Fred, why don't you take it all out now and blow it all between now and 3 o'clock? Jump on a plane for Greece and tell them all to go to hell. Go, man, take it all, blow it, buy yourself a Ferrari, go to Monte Carlo, play the tables, go on." Have you ever had that ambition? I mean, I'm all present company, of course, accepted here, because this could be a dangerous admission. But I submit to you, we've all had it. In fact, did you ever see a movie that Jack Lemmon made called How to Murder Your Wife? In the last scene, there is a courtroom scene in which Jack Lemmon walks around and he paints. He just takes a piece of chalk and he puts a button. He just draws a dot in front of the jury. Did you see that scene? He just draws a dot. And then he looks at the guy that's in the witness box and he says, "Look, if you could walk over to that button that I have drawn there, and nobody knew about it, nobody would ever make you guilty for it, and you could press that button, and magically, all those things which are holding your life down would disappear. Your mother-in-law, your wife, everybody in your life that's holding you down, and you could fly. Just press that button. Would you do it? Would you do it?" And the courtroom sits for a long, stunned moment of silence. If I gave you a button, a little pearl button that looks like one of these buttons you see on expensive apartments that ring the doorbell, and that button was a magic button that if you pressed it, tomorrow morning, your entire life would be transformed. You would be standing next to the Baccarat table at Monte Carlo, wearing a David Niven-type tuxedo and a tall, thin, curiously Swedish blonde who speaks with a Romanian accent is watching you play the tables as you devilishly are betting 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 on the turn of the dice. Would you do it? I think you may. I think you just may well do that. Good night, Simba. that ends tonight's salute to Hugh Downs. By George, it's been exciting. And, I don't know. I don't know. Let's face another thing. Within each one of us, not only is there a lion and a squirrel, there's also a starling, which tells dirty jokes and steals cigar butts. That's another story. This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for John Wingate.